is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. As we continue to spend more time alone during this pandemic, our streaming services have been working overtime. HBO and Showtime have replaced date nights and dinner parties. These days, pop culture has become a life raft to help keep us grounded and in many ways connected. But you might also feel as if you finally reached the end of a bottomless Netflix. So we wanted to help you find some joy in your next binge. That's why we're rolling out The Hit List. It's a monthly pop culture roundup that explores the latest in movies, music, TV, and more. This month, we'll try to focus on new releases from August and July, but really all summer is up for grabs. And here to grace our first installment, we've got Brooke Obie, award-winning film critic and author. Brooke, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us, Linda Holmes, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Great to have you with us, Linda.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, too.
And Jason Lipschutz, Senior Director of Music at Billboard. Welcome to 1A, Jason.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So, Linda, as we all sit at home, what do you think pop culture is providing for us right now?
Well, I think it's providing the same things that it always does. I think there's an element, there's certainly, you know, an element of time passing and distraction. There's also an element of, I think, what art always provides at its best, which is an opportunity to enjoy the benefits of other people's creativity. And I think when you feel disconnected from other people, as a lot of us do, I think it can be especially wonderful to kind of be treated to the fruits of other people's kind of minds and genius.
Brooke, what do you think? Has the pandemic changed our relationship with pop culture and the way we connect around it?
Well, what I'm hoping will happen from this pandemic is that we see how important the arts are. Everybody has been turning to pop culture as a way to cope and to get through and to be inspired. And so hopefully this will translate into actual funding that will go back into programs for school that have been cut in recent years. And that we'll be looking at ways to support artists, because this is, you know, a time where a lot of artists are also unemployed as a result of this pandemic. So there've been a lot of really great grants that have been going around, but it's just not enough. So hopefully what will come from this is an understanding of how vital the arts are and how we can continue to support artists.
Jason, the music industry has been upended by the pandemic. Concerts, tours have been canceled. Do you think we're listening to music differently now? You know, reaching for some classics for comfort or being a little more open to trying new music?
I think yes and no. I think that a lot of our listening habits have remained the same. You know, one of the things we do at Billboard is talk about Song of the Summer, and there's been a lot of comments about how it's such a strange summer to think about summer songs because there's such fewer gatherings, there's so many fewer parties and celebrations. But at the same time, we've seen listening habits trend toward the streaming industry anyway, where some of the biggest songs aren't being played in public, that people are just listening to them on their favorite streaming service instead of their favorite top 40 radio station. So I think that it's sped along the process of consumer habits that has already kind of been in place. But yeah, I think we've seen those trends happening for a while now.
Well, is there a song of the summer that's emerging as a front runner at this point?
Yeah, the song that is probably going to be this our song of the summer is the song Rockstar by DaBaby featuring Roddy Ricch. It's been number one on the Hot 100 for 7 weeks, and it's one of those songs that like I said is just a streaming behemoth. Hasn't really crossed over to top 40 radio, but it has such a huge fan base on streaming services, as well as it has spoken to the Black Lives Matter movement, where the song itself actually got a Black Lives Matter remix. And when DaBaby and Roddy Ricch performed the songs at the BET Awards a couple months ago, they did it with protesters surrounding them. So it's interesting to see how all of these different pop culture moments and cultural movements going on have affected our charts.
Well, let's dive into our first television show, which is Michaela Cole's I May Destroy You on HBO. It launched earlier this summer, but it's a season finale airs this week. We had Cole on the show earlier this month, and this is how she described it.
It's initially inspired by my own life. I had the unfortunate circumstance of being drugged and assaulted. And so I guess I wanted to write the story, because I think part of recovery is writing and sharing. But then from that, I found all these other stories. And so the series is exploring consent and the line between sexual exploitation and liberation in the modern day.
Linda, what did you think about I May Destroy You?
I thought this show was so impressive and smart. I think Cole, not only is it really well written, and she did some of the directing as well, and she's the lead of it. She's extraordinary in it. And I have to say, like, without spoiling anything, I'll just say, I think when you see the way the show concludes, it really, really casts even more light on just how thoughtful and interesting her take on this topic is. I think it's absolutely essential and brilliant. And I think, you know, it's been a little hard for HBO to kind of explain what it is, because people are used to her being sort of a comic actress. Her previous show, Chewing Gum, was a comedy. And I think it's been a little hard for them to figure out how to market it, but it's an extraordinary show. I would say sit with it. I really, really love and admire this show.
Well, the question of consent is wrestled with throughout the series. And here's one scene when Michaela Cole's character talks about boundaries.
Well, probably does think you're crazy. He thinks this is all a little uncalled for, and this personal space thing is all going a bit too far. And he's very confident in his view, because he's gone exploring to see for himself what boundaries and violations these women might be banging on about, because Bob's thorough. And on these explorations, Bob found the line that separated him from everything else. Rather than crossing it, he tiptoed on it. And he experienced this feeling of being on the boundary, on the border, right on the line of being neither in one place or another, and saw how in this gray area, where nothing was quite clear, no one could be clear.
Brooke, that's just one of the many scenes in the series that just kind of left me stunned. How does a scene like that and some of the other moments in the show mean to you?
Right. I mean, it's a fantastic monologue that Michaela Cole gives in episode 8. And so what I actually ended up doing was writing a piece for Esquire about what men can learn from the show and why men should be watching this show. And that monologue is a perfect example of that. It's explaining the ways that some men can operate within this gray area, that people are unaware of what consent actually means. And so they can get away with more things. And the more people are educated, for one, the more people can call out harmful behavior when they see it. But also, hopefully, people will stop operating or suggesting that things are a gray area, and we'll see what consent actually looks like, and will behave in a way that respects the boundaries and the consent of other people in these sexual situations.
An unrelated thing tweets, I haven't been able to stop playing the new album from BT, The Lost Art of Longing. It's full of upbeat energy. BT has been bringing to his music for decades, has hopeful messages needed in this era of uncertainty, and is timelessly catchy. Cat Sharkey said they've been watching the live stream of Urban Coral Reef in Miami, Florida. They tweeted, it is so relaxing and calming in these crazy times. Shelby writes on Facebook, I finished watching all of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I wish I had done it sooner. What were you waiting for, Shelby? She says, I loved it. Now I'm watching all of X-Files, and I'm just as glued to the screen. Shows that used to scare me as a kid are bringing me comfort in some pretty tough times. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp, the online counseling service dedicated to connecting you with a licensed counselor to help you overcome whatever stands in the way of your happiness. Fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a professional tailored to your needs. And if you aren't satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time, free of charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/1A to get 10% off your first month. Get the help you deserve with BetterHelp.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
It's presidential campaign season. Donald Trump is doubling down on appealing to just his base. And Joe Biden, he's trying to build a big, broad coalition of anyone who might give him a vote. I talk with two political reporters to see which strategy might work. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White, and we're rounding up the latest pop culture hits and binge-worthy shows for you with Brooke Obie, award-winning film critic and author, Linda Holmes, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, and Jason Lipschitz, senior director of music at Billboard. And here's what some of you had to say about your latest pop culture obsession while we're spending a little time on our own.
My wife doesn't understand how I can rewatch things so much, but this pandemic, I've been rewatching Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould's magnum opus, Better Call Saul, set in the Breaking Bad universe.
The shows that I've been watching the most since the pandemic began are The Umbrella Academy on Netflix, Avatar, The Last Airbender, also on Netflix, and Family Guy on Hulu.
I've gotten really into podcasts lately, specifically Race Chasers with Willem and Alaska from RuPaul's Drag Race, where they've been dissecting each episode of the show as it's aired, but they're also using it as a really good platform to, you know, keep people educated and to advocate and to support.
Schitt's Creek has been saving me during this pandemic. It's hilarious, it's light, it's funny, it's well written, it's just a good escape, and it's only 20 minutes long per episode, which is about my attention span after working from home all these months.
Thanks. That was Chris from Bloomington, Jonathan from Orlando, Zachary from St. Louis, and Liz from Silver Spring. Great recommendations for folks who haven't seen those things yet. But let's turn now to some new music. The song WAP from Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion debuted at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 chart and broke streaming records. It hit the highest number of first week streams in history. It's a record that was previously held by Ariana Grande's Seven Rings. Jason, why do you think WAP is such a hit?
You know, it's been a point of debate over the past week and a half since its release of what has made this song such an enormous hit. Like you said, it debuted at number one with the biggest debut streaming week ever, which is pretty remarkable. And I think part of it was the curiosity, obviously, the sexually explicit lyrics and the kind of racy music video that launched coinciding with the song itself dominated Twitter chatter over the first few days. But I think that's also selling short the star power of Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, who are two of the best rappers in the world right now and two of the biggest rappers in the world right now. I think pairing them on a track for the first time generated enormous interest. And as we see over the past week and a half, as this song has kind of settled into major hit status, it's less about a curiosity factor and more about people gravitating toward their lines, their lyricism, the beat itself. And I think it's going to be it's going to pivot from a curiosity into a long-lasting hit because Megan and Cardi are such gravitational forces in hip-hop right now.
Well, as you mentioned, it got a lot of attention because of its sexually explicit lyrics, but we did find a radio-friendly version. It's about halfway censored. Well, it's in the ways that it has to be for radio. So here, let's give it a go. This is WAP.
Can't hurt my feelings, but I like pain. If you ill, me and ask who's Zizzy when I ride the yeah. I'ma spell my name. Yeah, you telling with some wet. Bring up in a mop for this wet. Give me everything you got for this wet. When I from the top, make it drop. That's some wet. When I get a bucket and a mop, that's some wet, that's some wet. I'm talking wop, that's some wet. Macaroni in a pot, that's some wet, huh.
Okay, so for folks who haven't heard the non-censored version, Brooke, they're going to have to listen to it someplace other than the NPR station. But get into the reactions to the song, because there was a lot of noise around the lyrics. What can you tell us about some of that criticism?
Yeah, it was interesting. Obviously, there was this huge kind of conservative base outcry on the sexual freedom of this song and what it represents. Obviously, a complete double standard as in terms of, you know, having male rappers with huge explicit hits that don't get a fraction of the outcry. But honestly, I think it's become a positive for the song and for people in support of it as sort of a rallying point behind not only the song itself, but what it represents in terms of that sort of sexual freedom. And you know, the thing is, Cardi and Megan have huge young fan bases, but they're also incredibly smart. They're incredibly articulate. And they've already talked about, you know, that double standard and what they're trying to represent in hip hop. Obviously, female rappers dating back from Lil Kim to Foxy Brown to Nicki Minaj have all made sexually explicit songs. But the fact that this song is number one, and in my estimation might be settling it at number one for a long time, is really remarkable as a cultural shift.
Brooke, what did you make of some of the criticism around the track?
Well, I just thought it was so interesting, especially coming from men, because the song and the video as well, there are no men in the video. And these are women singing about their own bodies and the things that they want. So I just found it so interesting that men had so much to say about it, because it really wasn't about them at all. But I was really excited because it was using this 1993 sample from the song by Frank Ski, Hoes in This House. And that was essentially, it's a derogatory word that's been used throughout hip hop to demean and degrade Black women in particular. So for them to use that sample and then flip it around and claim it as something that they can't be harmed by, I just thought that was really amazing. And, you know, the beat is great. And people are upset because whenever a woman is actually owning their own sexuality and not being objectified, then there's kind of a conservatism that goes into this. But I mean, you know, it's very, very common for these kinds of songs to be, and these kinds of lyrics to be in the mouths of men talking about women. So it's just very interesting to me that when women actually are able to speak about their own bodies and the things that they want in a way that they feel is empowering for them, then there's a societal outcry.
Well, Rogue Trippin' tweeted on the line of music, Mariah Carey is chronologically releasing EPs of her past singles, including rare remixes, and is now releasing an album of previously unreleased material, including a new song sampling with Lauryn Hill titled Save the Day, an absolute highlight of 2020. And Emmanuel tweets, I'm interested in what Apple Music has been doing. They officially added Beats One to their platform and announced a lot of new stations with high profile names. What does Jason think about that? Jason, really quickly, your thoughts.
Yeah, I think that I did notice that, and I think that both Apple Music and Spotify, as well as YouTube Music, I think everyone is sort of gearing up and trying to figure out how to appeal to new consumers, especially during this pandemic. We always talk kind of about the streaming wars in terms of Netflix versus HBO Max versus Hulu, et cetera. But it's been interesting to watch these music-first streaming services kind of take these slight little tweaks to their formula to try to bring in new listeners.
Well, Linda, I want to get into another show that's garnered a lot of excitement, HBO's new series, Lovecraft Country. The first episode dropped on Sunday. It's being released one episode at a time, and I will admit it was one of the more stressful recent television watching experiences I have had recently. Give us a rundown of the show. What's it about?
So Lovecraft Country is not actually based on H.P. Lovecraft work. It's sort of a reference. The lead character likes horror, and it's a horror show, but it's based on a novel. And excuse me, the novel, like the show, is essentially a series of interconnected stories. So that first episode, as you watch the show, I've seen the first five, as you watch the show, they're all kind of contained stories. The next episode feels very different from that first episode, but then they're all connected by a thread. So it's kind of like, you know, if you think of it as like a charm bracelet with like little individual stories all hanging from this one thread. And it's horror, but it's also a family story. It's about a guy who goes on a kind of a journey with his best friend from childhood and his uncle to find his missing father. And I don't want to say too much about where it goes, but it's really, really a terrific show. It's explicitly trying to kind of, I think, reject the fact that Lovecraft himself, as a horror writer, was deeply racist, and a lot of his work has been kind of rejected and reconsidered on that basis. This is an effort to kind of talk about pulp stories in a different way. The kind of the horror framing here is about racism and racist violence and the threat, for example, from it's set in the 1950s, and when you see these characters, they are threatened by police officers, white police officers, as they're on this trip. It's the best that horror can be, I think, for me, is reflecting a real social fear, a real kind of socially based frightening experience. I think that's why that first episode is so unsettling, is that it uses horror in a way that parallels real life, which is what a lot of the best horror does.
Brooke, why is Lovecraft Country one of the shows you're so excited about right now?
I'm so excited about this show because there really isn't anything like it. This is a genre. We have, you know, Jordan Peele, who serves as an executive producer on this as well, who has been so instrumental in opening the door of horror to a Black audience. And so to have Black characters who are at the center of this, and it's also sci-fi, there are monsters, there's aliens, you know, and Black girls who are into astronomy. And it's just so many things that we don't typically see. So I just am very excited about it. I think it's a wonderful show.
We're talking to Brooke Obie, award-winning film critic and author, Linda Holmes, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, and Jason Lipschitz, senior director of music at Billboard. And we are hearing from you. Da Purple Sharpie tweeted about WAP saying, "The song, while super provocative, fills me, a Black woman, with the strength and energy that I need during this quarantine to get through the day. It's really empowering, to be honest." It's our Pop Culture Roundup. We're talking about the latest songs, shows, and movies for your days indoors. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
How do we reinvent ourselves? And what's the secret to living longer? I'm Anoush Zomorodi. Each week on NPR's TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey with TED speakers to seek a deeper understanding of the world and to figure out new ways to think and create. Listen now.
So we're talking about some of the big releases that we absolutely have to talk about this summer with Brooke Obie, award-winning film critic and author, Linda Holmes, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, and Jason Lipschitz, senior director of music at Billboard. I want to turn back to music. Taylor Swift dropped a new surprise album, Folklore, at the end of July. Jason, here's one of your favorite songs from the album called Invisible String.
Green was the color of the grass where I used to read at Centennial Park. Used to think I would meet somebody there. Teal was the color of your shirt when you were 16 at the yogurt shop. You used to work at to make a little money. Time, curious time, give me no compass.
Jason, tell us a bit about this album and how it's being received.
It's been widely acclaimed, actually, maybe the garnering the best reviews of Taylor Swift's career. And she put out an album last year, Lover, which was a huge success. And she had set up these Lover Fests. Basically, instead of doing a full-fledged tour, she had mini festivals planned for a couple different places in the U.S. as well as performing at Glastonbury over in the U.K. Obviously, none of those shows happened, and instead, she made a kind of quiet, understated, indie folk-influenced pop album with her frequent collaborator Jack Antonoff, who's worked on her past few albums, but also Aaron Dessner, who is the main producer for the indie rock stalwart band The National. And what's interesting about this album is, I think, as a longtime Taylor Swift fan, I've kind of been waiting for her to make an album like this, just because she's such a strong songwriter. And when you hear her early work and working in the mode of country pop, you could tell that she's just a master at hook construction, verse construction, detail, and storytelling. And over the past 5 years or so, she's really pivoted to kind of top 40 maximalist pop, working with someone like Max Martin a great deal. What this album has done, and she's talked about how she made this album because of the quarantine, because she was kind of stuck and creatively restless a little bit. She wasn't planning on making an album this year. what you hear is that storytelling kind of coming to life in a new way as kind of this indie alternative prism being refracted through what she's doing on a singer-songwriter basis. So, you know, it's a huge hit, I think partially because it's her most cohesive album in a bit, but also it's had a number one single already with the song Cardigan. I think it's going to be an interesting album to see persist through the fall as kind of a woodsier look for Taylor Swift. And also with that critical acclaim, will she be a front runner at the Grammys this year? She has already won two Album of the Year trophies over the course of her career, and her last two albums did not get nominated in that category. I think Folklore definitely will, and it'll be interesting to see its chances in the next couple months.
Well, we've been talking about some of the big releases this summer, but I want to make sure we spend some time on your hit list. We've also been hearing from you. David wrote on our Facebook page, just finished Dead to Me, ridiculous melodrama with absurd story connection, too much random luck, and too many threads. Love it. Kelly tweets, quarantine has gotten me into watching Korean dramas on Netflix. Itaewon Class and Crash Landing on You were two that I really enjoyed. And James tweets, I have finally started watching Underground, which is a historical drama on Hulu. And as a history nerd, this was the best telling of the complexities of slavery in this country that I have seen since Roots. Very relevant for the issues we are still facing today. Well, one show we've had our eye on is the reboot of The Babysitter's Club, released on Netflix earlier this summer. And this is 1A producer Morgan Givens talking about his excitement for the new series.
Christy was my favorite character. Playing softball, clearly a tomboy. My little queer heart was so excited because, you know, they had to do everything kind of in subtext back then. I mean, they still do it in subtext. But The Babysitter's Club kept me so much company. Like, I actually turned into a babysitter for a summer because of The Babysitter's Club. And the Disney show, the theme song from the Disney show, I will never forget. Say hello to your friends, Babysitter's Club. Say hello to the people who care. They cared about me. Christy was there when I needed her.
So, Linda, I don't know that I was the target demographic for this series, but I may or may not have watched it while cleaning the house. How did Netflix do in recreating this childhood favorite?
Well, you know, I was not necessarily the target audience for it either. The Babysitter's Club was a little bit after me as a kid, just by a few years. And I think what I love about hearing that, I love hearing that reaction from Morgan, because there is a place in the world for things that are groundbreaking and high art and all that stuff. But there is also a place in the world for things that are just deeply, deeply loved. And that's one of the things that I believe about pop culture, is that it really is healing and special to people to have things that are deeply, deeply, that they deeply, deeply love, whether or not it expands your worldview or whatever. I think Netflix did a really good job with this series. And I think they gave people something that gives them that sense of like, oh, wow, this is something I can embrace and feel good about. It's one of the things where like high-end prestige television has done so much to improve TV, but you also have to make sure that there are still things that are just kind of like, it's okay for some things to be really high quality comfort watches. And I think that's kind of what this was. It's a comfortable, but really like, warm and kind of positive thing. And I think there's absolutely a place for that. I think they did a really good job with this, actually.
Well, Jason, you brought some new music. One of your personal favorites, Victoria Monet and her song Experience. Let's listen. About Victoria Monet, Jason, and as an artist, and about this song.
Yeah, so Victoria Monet is a pretty experienced, forgive the pun, the song's experience, singer-songwriter who debuted years back in the early 2010s as a performer, failed to find really crossover success, but then established herself as one of the most in-demand pop songwriters working, primarily through her work with Ariana Grande. She co-wrote Seven Rings, she co-wrote Thank You Next, both of which hit number one on the Hot 100. And a couple weeks ago, Victoria Monet stepped back in as an artist with a project called Jaguar. You just heard Experience featuring Khalid and S.G. Lewis, which is a really great pop song. But I think that I really hope that this time she does stick as a not only a songwriter, but as a singer-songwriter, just because she's such a professional, well-crafted songwriter, but also a really nuanced vocalist who knows how to deliver a really great kind of sexy R&B song, but also a kind of crossover up-tempo pop song. She's one of my favorite artists, kind of under the radar right now, and I hope more people experience her in this light.
Well, keeping with music, Brooke, you wanted to add to everyone's radar Chloe and Halle. They are a sister R&B group, and here's one of their latest songs, Do It. So the duo has been stepping up the quarantine performance game. How have they adapted to being virtual, Brooke?
So what's been so amazing to see is them turn their tennis court in their backyard into a studio, a stage. They have redesigned this tennis court so many different ways throughout this quarantine and given us iconic performances. They're just so talented. As Beyoncé's artist on her Parkwood Entertainment label, she's just been training them for years since they were very young children.
They were discovered on YouTube.
Right, exactly. And so she's just been training them to be able to perform songs live as well as in the studio. And that's just not that common, that you can be able to sing and dance at the same time and do it well. And so what they've been doing is they were just on Jimmy Kimmel the other night and they performed Do It, but they performed it in a completely different way. They just keep reinventing the song every time they perform. And it's just, they stripped it down. It's acoustic for the Jimmy Kimmel performance. And they're just, shows their talent. They sing, they dance, they play guitar, they play the piano, so many different instruments, and they produce all their own vocals. They're just fantastic.
Well, another Netflix recommendation here from Lisa, who tweets, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend on Netflix has been giving me so much. In addition to its raunchy yet sweet style, there's amazing Broadway-worthy musical numbers and a, well, therapeutic running thread about mental illness. Lisa, thanks for that recommendation. And we didn't get to talk about one of Jason's favorites, but we'll listen to it on the way out today. This is UK artist Westerman from his new album, Your Hero Is Not Dead. We've been talking to Brooke Obie, award-winning film critic and author, Linda Holmes, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, and Jason Lipschitz, senior director of music at Billboard. Thanks, everybody, for giving us some new shows and music to enjoy. And you can find this month's full hit list on our website, the1a.org. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.
Turn back around, come and gee, walk me through the blue corn and sundown.